As I told you, I had once proposed for the ashram school a program. I had made a curriculum or a syllabus, Spiritual History of India, that was the title. And I had started with the Veda, Upanishad, Bhagavad Gita, Indian philosophies, movements of bhakti, then eclipse, and then restarting, new renaissance, coming up to Sri Aurobindo. And the impression that I had created was that Sri Aurobindo is the culmination of all that has gone before, a point of fulfillment of all that had been aspired for. Now, Mother answered with a big bang to me when I presented this to her. And she answered and advised me as to what I should really concentrate upon. So, as I told you, that was my first lecture on the day before yesterday, in fulfillment of what Mother had said. So I would like to read with you what she had written for me. Réponse de mère, au professeur de l'école, lorsqu'on lui a annoncé que les nouvelles classes spéciales de l'après-midi à la bibliothèque avaient choisi pour premier thème de recherche l'histoire spirituelle de l'Inde. Non, ça ne va pas. Ce n'est pas comme cela que l'on doit faire. D'abord, il faut commencer par un Big Bang. Vous voulez montrer la continuité de l'histoire, comme si Sri Aurobindo était l'aboutissement, le sommet. Mais c'est complètement faux. Sri Aurobindo n'appartient pas à l'histoire. Il est en dehors et au-delà de l'histoire. Jusqu'à la naissance de Sri Aurobindo, les religions et les spiritualités se sont toujours appuyées sur les personnalités du passé. Et elles avaient pour but la négation de la vie sur la terre. Alors, vous aviez le choix entre une vie dans ce monde avec sa petite ronde de plaisir et de peine, de joie et de souffrance, et la menace de l'enfer si vous ne vous conduisez pas convenablement. Ou bien, une chute dans un autre monde, ciel, nirvana, moksha, libération. Entre les deux, il n'y a pas grand-chose à choisir. Ils sont également mauvais. Sri Aurobindo nous a dit que c'était justement l'erreur fondamentale qui a entraîné la faiblesse et la dégradation de l'Inde. Le bouddhisme, le jainisme, l'illusionnisme ont suffi à miner toute l'énergie du pays. Certes, l'Inde est le seul endroit du monde qui ait encore conscience de quelque chose d'autre que la matière. Les autres pays l'ont tout à fait oublié. L'Europe, l'Amérique et ailleurs. C'est pourquoi l'Inde garde toujours un message à délivrer au monde. Mais pour le moment, elle patauge Elle patauge et se roule dans la boue. Sri Aurobindo nous a montré que la vérité ne consiste pas à s'enfuir de la vie terrestre, mais à y rester pour la transformer et la diviniser, afin que le divin puisse se manifester ici, dans ce monde physique. C'est cela que vous devez dire à votre première réunion. Être un peu carré et ferme. Après, et seulement après, quand vous aurez dit cela fortement, carrément, sans mâcher vos mots, vous pourrez continuer à les amuser avec l'histoire de religion et des chefs spirituels et religieux. Après, et seulement après, vous pourrez montrer le germe de faiblesse et de mensonge qu'ils ont abrité et prêché. Après et seulement après, vous pourrez discerner ici et là, de temps en temps, une intuition que quelque chose d'autre est possible, comme dans les Védas, par exemple, l'invitation à descendre tout au fond de la caverne de Pani. Dans les Tantras aussi, une petite lumière qui brille. Je suggère que vous adoptiez comme devise de votre première recherche cette phrase de Sri Aurobindo. Nous n'appartons pas aux aurores passées, mais au midi de l'avenir. Puis, Mère a donné un message spécial pour l'école. Sri Aurobindo n'appartient pas au passé ni à l'histoire. Sri Aurobindo est l'avenir en marche vers sa réalisation. Il nous faut donc nous revêtir d'une jeunesse éternelle pour pouvoir avancer avec la rapidité voulue et ne pas être des retardataires sur le chemin. Actually, Mother had put here one big square, carrément. She herself had drawn a square. It is not here, but the paper which she sent me had this big square written on it to indicate that I should be square and should tell all my students very squarely with a big bang. So let me read now in English, all right? Mother's answer in English to the school's teachers when she was told that the new special afternoon classes at the library had chosen as a first research theme India's spiritual history. No, it won't do. It is not to be done that way. You should begin with a big bang. You were trying to show the continuity of history with Sri Aurobindo as the outcome, the culmination. It is false entirely. Sri Aurobindo does not belong to history. He is outside and beyond history. Till the birth of Sri Aurobindo, religions and spiritualities were always centered on past figures, and they were showing as a goal the negation of life upon earth. So you had a choice between two alternatives, either a life in this world, which is round of petty pleasures and pains, joys and sufferings, threatened by hell if you were not behaving properly, or an escape into another world, heaven, nirvana, moksha, liberation. Between these two, there is nothing much to choose. They are equally bad. Sri Aurobindo has told us that this was a fundamental mistake which accounts for the weakness and degradation of India. Buddhism, Jainism, illusionism were sufficient to sap all energy out of the country. True, India is the only place in the world which is still aware that something else than matter exists. The other countries have quite forgotten it. Europe, America, and elsewhere. That is why she still has a message to preserve and deliver to the world. But at present, she is splashing and floundering in the muddle. Sri Aurobindo has shown that the truth does not lie in running away from earthly life, but in remaining in it, to transform it, divinize it, so that the divine can manifest here in this physical world. You should tell all this at the first meetings. You should be square and frank. Then, when this is told strongly, squarely, and there is no doubt about it, and then only you can go on and amuse them with the history of religions and religious or spiritual leaders. Then, and then only, you will be able to show the seed of weakness and falsehood that they were harbored and proclaimed. Then, and then only, you will be able to discern from time to time, from place to place, an intuition that something else is possible. In the Vedas, for instance, the injunction to descend deep into the cave of the Panis. In the Tantras also, a little light burning. I may add that you could adopt as motto for your first project this quotation of Sri Aurobindo. We do not belong to the past dawns, but to the noons of the future. Message from mother to the school. Sri Aurobindo does not belong to the past nor to history. Sri Aurobindo is a future advancing towards its realization. Thus we must shelter the eternal youth required for a speedy advance in order not to become laggards on the way. This word laggards, we have taken half an hour to translate. Retardataire, that is the French word there, that which retards you. So Pavitrada and I had sat down together for quite some time to translate into English. Then we found this word laggards, because lag behind, so laggards are those who remain behind. This was 5th April 1967. As I told you day before yesterday, I had really given you the first lecture only on that day. All that was a preparation to be able to tell you what mother has said here, and I will take another time, long, long time, to dilate upon it. In fact, when I read the Life Divine and Synthesis of Yoga, it is basically for this purpose. Later on, I'll deal with many other things. So we come back to the Synthesis of Yoga. The Utsaha, the zeal for the Lord that eats us up. The necessity of personal effort, particularly during the first period, until we are able to have contact with the Divine, and not to listen to the advice that God will do everything for you, don't worry. This is the period when we must ask every part of our being to strain and to work hard and harder and still harder. Always, indeed, it is the higher power that acts. Our sense of personal effort and aspiration comes from the attempt of the egoistic mind to identify itself in a wrong and imperfect way with the workings of the divine force. It persists in applying to experience on a supernormal plane the ordinary terms of mentality which it applies to its normal experiences in the world. In the world, we act with a sense of egoism. We claim the universal forces that work in us as our own. We claim as the effect of our personal will, wisdom, force, virtue, the selective, formative, progressive action of the transcendent in this frame of mind, life and body. Enlightenment brings to us the knowledge that the ego is only an instrument. We begin to perceive and feel that these things are our own in the sense that they belong to our supreme and integral self, one with the transcendence, not to the instrumental ego. Our limitations and distortions are our contribution to the working. The true power in it is the Divine's. When the human ego realizes that its will is a tool, its wisdom, ignorance and childishness, its power an infant's groping, its virtue a pretentious impurity, it learns to trust itself to that which transcends it, that is its salvation. The apparent freedom and self-assertion of our personal being to which we are so profoundly attached conceal a most pitiable subjection to a thousand suggestions, impulsions, forces which we have made extraneous to our little person. Our ego, boasting of freedom, he is at every moment the slave, toy and puppet of countless beings, powers, forces, influences in universal nature. Its surrender, the self-abnegation of ego in the divine, is its self-fulfillment. Its surrender to that which transcends it is its liberation from bonds and limits and its perfect freedom. This is one of the most important statements about the ego and the divine and their relationship. So I will just make a little diagram for you. Each one of us is seated in the vast compass of the whole universe.
which issues from the Divine, who is at once immobile and mobile. This mobility is a tremendous creative movement. And in this movement, at a certain point, there is a blockade. As a result of this blockade, a small little pebble is created. In this vast movement, it's a small little pebble which is created because of this blockade. But this blockade does not mean that this force is not transmitted. It is transmitted but feebly. Therefore, we don't feel here in our egoism the tremendous force which is behind. It is manageable force, a small little force. We seem to be moving round and round. And it is here, this force enters here as it were. We catch that force. It is woven into us as it were. Actually force comes from here. All this is from here. And we think that this force is our force. My force. Whatever force you catch, you identify yourself with that one. And if this force is already moving forward, but this ego feels that this force is moving because of its catching it. It has caught it. Already the force is moving in its own way. But because you identify yourself with it, you feel that this is a force, my force, which is moving forward. Actually, it is all moving from here. Now, actually, because you catch it, the force becomes weakened. You loosen the whole thing. The force which is coming here, by catching it, the force of it is slightly weakened, diluted. Therefore, when this force is trying to move towards its own movement, you feel as if there's a big resistance. Actually, resistance is your own. You are trying to catch it. Actually, it's moving forward by itself. But because you catch it, you feel a resistance. Now, already the force is trying to move forward. So you feel as if you are making a big effort to move forward. Actually, the movement is moving already. But because you are resisting and identifying yourself with it, it becomes weaker and the force behind is pushing you. You feel therefore a kind of burden behind you. It is that burden which makes you feel, I am making an effort. You are making an effort. Actually, you are not seeing that actually the movement is already going on. Even in spite of you, without you. This is what gives you the sense of personal effort. But as Sri Aurobindo says, always it is the power of the Divine that acts. Always it is this power which is acting. It is that which is behind it. When you become enlightened, you become enlightened when this blockade is removed. Normally, when this enlightenment is given in terms, intellectual terms, as I am doing now, our natural tendency would be, all right, I will not catch it. I allow the force to pass by me. You do nothing, as it were. This is the kind of conclusion that many people derive out of this statement which I am making. If it is divine force which is working, it will work out whether I do anything or not. So I stop doing anything. It doesn't stop in that way. It's a wrong way of dealing with it. Unless you break this ego here, whether you allow this to pass or not to pass, ego remains. It will always create this sense, I am doing. And the way by which you can break this ego is to work behind. This dam is there, blockade is here. Unless you break this blockade, you won't be liberated from this sense. It's not merely by hearing that ego is not the doer. Divine is the doer. Merely by hearing, you won't enter into this consciousness. Unless you break this dam. Now this dam consists of what? Exclusive concentration of consciousness. Our concentration is exclusively concentrated upon this way. If you look at your whole life, you will find your whole concentration is moving forward. All that is around you. You look at your senses. All the senses open outwards. Your eyes open outwards. Your ears are open to the sounds coming from outside. They open outwards. The touches are all coming from outside. You feel the sense of touch only when it comes from outside. It tends to touch things from outside. And since we are bound by these senses, we are all open outward. Because we are open outward, this blockade is created. You are outward, therefore over here, there is no consciousness at all this way. So when consciousness is absent, again and again and again, a blockade is created. Therefore, instead of moving this way outward, move inward. This is all the meaning of meditation. Instead of moving outward, you withdraw and go inward. And if you do it repeatedly, on and on and on, then this dam will be broken. And once you enter here, you will see a beautiful palace of the divine. You don't need to create a palace of the divine. That is already here. You don't need to fabricate anything. It's already here. Only you have to turn your gaze from here to here. All yoga is turning inward. It is to stop our exclusive concentration of consciousness outward by an opposite movement in which you turn inward. All yoga implies inwardization. Turn inward. Move inward. When you close your eyes and sit for meditation, unless you strive to break this, which keeps you always outward, when you sit down for meditation, a slight sound coming from outside, immediately you are drawn outside. Very little time is available to us in our life when we can sit down really quietly and move inward. This is the entire science of yoga. All the time we are living outward, yoga means shifting from attention outward to attention inward. And then again coming back outward. Once you have gone here, Very often the tendency is to go outward, inward, and remain there. Then life is rejected. All the movement here is thrown out. It's another kind of ignorance. This is one kind of ignorance, this is another kind of ignorance. That is why the Isha Upanishad says that this is a movement of ignorance and this is a movement of knowledge. But if that movement of knowledge is only here, then that is also a darkness. Because then you lose the whole outer world. You break the dam, break the boundary, enter here, contact the divine, and then come back again. But with the cancellation of the ego. That's the only way of cancelling. You can't cancel ego merely by thinking out that I am not doer. I am not ego. It's simply by saying it doesn't destroy itself. It goes on like a button on the sea, constantly going on and on. It can't be destroyed. If you want to destroy it, you have got to go here, realize it. The moment you realize it, this goes away. And then you can come back here without this, then you become a center, but a divine center. The divine himself then moves, and without any resistance, his power is not at all diminished, no dilution. It moves omnipotently. The same force of the divine powerfully is transmitted through the center that we are, truly. We are not the ego. There is a center which is called Jivatma. That is the real individual. That center is the divine himself. It's a fine partial manifestation of the divine himself. When this happens, there is no personal effort at all. Because all the force comes from here. And you know this all force comes here. You are only the instrument here. An instrument which is completely in the hands of the divine. We had once spoken of the analogy of the bow. Take a bow. How does a bow work? Bow can't work by itself. You need an archer. Archer takes a bow in the hand, takes an arrow, fixes the arrow himself. Bow itself can't fix itself. The arrow is fixed by the archer. Where the arrow is to be shot is decided by the archer. It uses the bow only to fix it and to shoot at the target. And that is all. Such is the real condition of our true being. The Jivatman is of this nature. It's a bow in the hands of the divine. Always. But because of this blockade, this ego is created, it diminishes the force which is coming from here. And then when that force is pushing forward, you feel I am making an effort. That is all the meaning of personal effort. The ego stops the force, but the force pushes it. This pushing is recognized by ego as its effort, because it is passing through it. It is exactly like the cart and the dog moving under the moving cart. The dog feels that the cart is moving because of its moving under it. But actually the cart moves on its own. So Sri Aurobindo speaks of three stages in the previous paragraph that we read yesterday. First is the process of contact. a long, long process in which you turn inward, then you become sayujyas. You become united with the divine. This is where the ego is destroyed. You unite here, ego is destroyed there. It's like electric current. Once you realize your unity here, ego falls down. Then the third step starts, you become the divine center, because this is gone and the force moves without any boundaries, without any blockade. Until this happens, the idea of personal effort persists. And you should not therefore be idle. You make the sense of effort a part of your own development. But this effort is to be turned inward. And inward outward, so that a balance is maintained in your being until the ego is abolished and there is a powerful instrument of the divine in the world, which works in the world without boundaries, without bounds. But this is only one side of the force that works for perfection. The process of the integral yoga has three stages, not indeed sharply distinguished or separate, but in a certain measure successive. There must be first the effort towards at least an initial and enabling self-transcendence and contact with the divine. The backward movement, inward movement. Next, the reception of that which transcends, that with which we have gained communion, into ourselves for the transformation of our whole conscious being. I spoke yesterday of the fountain. When you go near the divine, there's a big fountain of divine consciousness. It bathes you as you return to it. Last, the utilization of our transformed humanity as a divine center in the world. You realize the Jivatman in you, and then through that Jivatman, you allow the divine force to manifest. So long as the contact with the divine is not in some considerable degree established, so long as there is not some measure of sustained identity, sayujya, the element of personal effort must normally predominate. But in proportion as this contact establishes itself, the sadhaka must become conscious that a force other than his own, a force transcending his egoistic endeavor and capacity, is at work in him. And to this power, he learns progressively to submit himself and delivers up to it the charge of his yoga. Once you reach this point, then everything then becomes the responsibility of the archer. The bow remains the bow. The bow doesn't make an effort now to bring out the arrow, to fix it, to make the target and to shoot, because it can't do even if it tries. It never does. We are only trying to imitate the divine in our ignorant way. We become the archer, as it were. We become the fixers of the target. We shoot it. But it's only like a monkey imitating man when he sees man doing something. If the man wears a cap, the monkey also wears a cap, but in his own clumsy manner. Similarly, we are only imitators. When we stop imitating, open ourselves to the divine goes on doing his work without any boundary.
In the end, his own will and force become one with the higher power. He merges them in the divine will and is transcendent and universal force. He finds it thenceforward presiding over the necessary transformation of his mental, vital and physical being with an impartial wisdom and provident effectivity of which the eager and interested ego is not capable. It is when this identification and this self-merging are complete that the divine center in the world is ready, purified, liberated, plastic, illumined. It can begin to serve as a means for the direct action of a supreme power in the larger yoga of humanity or superhumanity, of the earth's spiritual progression or its transformation. There is always a question for every individual how to be helpful to the others, how to serve mankind. This is the answer. If you really want to serve mankind, this is the condition. Abolition of egoism, allowing the supreme force to work through you as a divine center. Then all that you do will work for the unity of mankind, for the progression of mankind. You really help mankind. We continue now, which you read already. Always indeed it is the higher power that acts. We have seen already. All these forces actually the higher power. Always indeed it is the higher power that acts. Our sense of personal effort and aspiration comes from the attempt of the egoistic mind to identify itself in a wrong and imperfect way with the workings of the divine force. It persists in applying to experience on a supernormal plane the ordinary terms of mentality which it applies to its normal experiences in the world. It's actually a very refined way of saying that the ego is like a monkey which is imitating the forces of the higher force. It's a very refined way of saying. But actually it says that ego is like a monkey which simply imitates what is happening behind and applies the higher to the lower in its own way, which is done very clumsily. In the world, we act with a sense of egoism. We claim the universal forces that work in us as our own. We claim as the effect of our personal will, wisdom, force, virtue, the selective, formative, progressive action of the transcendent in this frame of mind, life and body. Enlightenment brings, when you turn backward, inward, when you are enlightened, then this enlightenment brings to us the knowledge that the ego is only an instrument. We begin to perceive and feel that these things are our own in the sense that they belong to our supreme and integral self. Integral self is the self which is both immobile and mobile at the same time. One with the transcendent. Not to the instrumental ego. Our limitations and distortions are our contribution to the working. What we are contributing is to weaken the force. We only, because of our egoism, the force which is coming from outside, which is powerful, we weaken it. So our limitations and distortions are our contribution. We contribute only by distorting, by limiting it, by weakening it. The true power in it is the divine's. When the human ego realizes that its will is a tool, its wisdom, ignorance and childishness, we then realize, in egoism we always say, I am now more mature, I am more experienced, I am really wise. So Sri Aurobindo breaks that wisdom and says, his wisdom is only ignorance and childishness. His power is an infant's groping. His virtue, a pretentious impurity. What I say is my virtue, it is only a purity which is pretentious, which doesn't exist. You pretend to be virtuous. Actually, nobody is virtuous unless this happens. All virtue, all claim to virtue is a pretense. Pretentious impurity. And learns to trust itself. The ego must learn to trust itself to that which transcends it. That is its salvation. The apparent freedom and self-assertion of our personal being to which we are so profoundly attached. In our egoism we feel we are free. I decide myself what I am to do. It is my freedom. But this freedom is nothing but a most pitiable subjection to a thousand suggestions, impulsions, forces which we have made extraneous to our little person. Our ego, boasting of freedom, is at every moment the slave, toy, and puppet of countless beings, powers, forces, influences in universal nature. The self-abnegation of the ego in the divine is its self-fulfillment. Its surrender to that which transcends it is its liberation from bonds and limits and its perfect freedom. Now this word surrender is a very important word. There is a science and art of surrender. Let us deal with it a little. We shall come to this question again and again. But at this moment, this word is given in the last line, so we shall only deal with it to that extent. Supposing this is the symbol of the divine, and this is a symbol of this Jivatman. This is more complex, this is less complex. But it is the image of the divine. It's like the divine looking at himself in a small mirror. This mirror also is fabricated by him. It is he who fabricates his mirror. It is he who looks into the mirror. It's a partial manifestation of himself. Now, usually in our ordinary circumstances, when you look to your mirror, your face confronts you. You are on this side and the other side is the image of yours. In other words, we have got two important words, subjective and objective. This is subjective. And here, this is a process of objectivization. So there is a difference between these two only to this extent. This is subjective, this is objective. Now this objective, however, is not, and this is a very important point, is not like a puppet of the subjective. Usually in the mirror, your reflection is a puppet. Whatever you do here is reflected there automatically. So the analogy is not complete. In the mirror, whatever subject does, the object does. It simply reflects. So in a sense, it is only puppetry. What is the original subject?
But in this process, something more happens in the objectivization. His subjective consciousness is also brought into this. This reflection is not only an objective reflection of the content of the subjective, but it's also a reflection of the subjective, that is the element which is also present here. The objective is not only objective. This objective also contains in itself a subjectivity. And therefore, the object behaves as a subject. It is like a mother giving birth to a child. That is a better analogy than a mirror. The child, when it is born, is a reflection of the mother. It's a subject giving rise to object. Very similar to the mother. But the child is not a puppet of the mother. It's not as if whenever mother does something, the child does something. The mother has a power of initiative action. The child also has the power of initiative action. This initiative action has a different angle. That is to say, while the angle of this subjective is turned this way, the angle of this is turned this way. And this angle, just as this angle is free, similarly, this is also free. The freedom of the subject is also transmitted to this object. Therefore, it is also free. This is the real meaning of what is called the play. Mere puppetry is not play. Subject becoming an object and repeating in the object whatever it is, is no play. The object also repeats the subject completely. Not only the contents, but also the subjectivity is also present in the objectivity. So every object has subjectivity. Each one of us is also subjective. It regards the divine as his object. He does not create the object, but there is a sense of objectivity with regard to the object. Now, this is the complexity of subjectivity and objectivity. As a result, there is a very important psychological condition which is created. There is a very interesting story that mother has given. This is in the context of Durga. You know, Durga is one of the manifestations of the divine, a power of the divine, as many other powers of the divine, which is called gods and goddesses. All gods and goddesses are the powers of the divine. They are all instruments of the divine. And surprisingly, one day mother said, I taught Durga how to surrender herself to the divine. Now, what is the meaning of it? Durga is always an instrument of the divine. Where is the question of her surrender to the divine? Already knows herself to be the instrument. So the knowledge of being instrument of the divine is not sufficient. There is something much more to it. There is a play in which you are not merely a puppet of the divine, but you offer yourself to the divine. Now this offering yourself to the divine
is not an act of puppetry. It is creative. It is himself, but in that form.
It is the divine himself surrendering or offering himself to the divine. But from this side, this objectivization also translates its subjectivity. So this objective is also subjective in character. This subjective character offers itself to the divine. This conscious offering is surrender.
Conscious offering of the objective figure of the divine in its subjective consciousness, offering itself to the divine, that is surrender. To know that you are a big force behind is one realization. But to turn back again to the divine and offering all that comes from the divine to the divine again, that is the method by which ego can be abolished. The abolition of ego is not only a realization that there is a divine force which is working. You still have the egoism of being an instrument of the divine. So egoism is not abolished. It's only a partial success. From your side, knowing all this, this subjectivity comes back again, offers itself to the divine. It is the child smiling at the mother. The mother has produced the child. It's an objective figure of the mother. But having come there, the child behaves in interplay. Even when the mother is not smiling, the child may smile. It's not only puppetry. And by the child's smile, the mother's heart gets much more fulfilled. Uninvited, if the child smiles at the mother feels greatly fulfilled. Uninvited. Because the child itself feels happy. And that happiness pours itself out and manifests as a smile. The child does not merely do what the mother tells it. On her own, the child feels like offering. This is the condition in which surrender obtains. It is that Sri Aurobindo speaks in this last sentence. The self-abnegation of the ego in the divine is its self-fulfillment. Its surrender to that which transcends it is its liberation from bonds and limits and its perfect freedom. We shall come to this subject again when you come to some other chapters, but this is only a kind of an aperçu, a glimpse of the real meaning of surrender. The subjective becoming objective and objective expressing itself as subjective and returning to the object with a tremendous sense of submission, happy submission, not willy-nilly like a slave under compulsion, but freely, freely offering itself to the divine. That is his perfect freedom. But still, in the practical development, each of the three stages has its necessity and utility and must be given its time or its place. It will not do. It cannot be safe or effective to begin with the last and highest alone. It would not be the right course, either, to leap prematurely from one to the another. If right from the first stage you say, all is divine, when ego is not abolished, it will be disastrous. As long as you are egoistic, admit you are egoistic, and work out, step by step, until the third stage arises, when ego itself falls down. For even if from the beginning we recognize in mind and heart the Supreme, there are elements of the nature which long prevent the recognition from becoming realization. Mere intellectual knowledge or even some spiritual knowledge is not enough. It's not realization. Merely to say I am not the doer is not enough. It's a good step forward, but not good enough. You must realize that you are not the doer. But without realization, our mental belief cannot become a dynamic reality. It is still only a figure of knowledge, not a living truth, an idea, not yet a power. And even if realization has begun, it may be dangerous to imagine or to assume too soon that we are altogether in the hands of the Supreme or are acting as His instrument. Many people who turn to yoga, they have illusion. The moment they turn to the Divine, they think that they have now become instruments of the Divine. That there is a vast difference, a long road to go. Once one sadhak wrote to the mother saying, Mother, I want to do divine work. So mother answered, first you do the work for the divine, then you will be able to do divine's work. There are steps. You cannot say immediately, I now want to do divine's work. To be able to do divine's work, you must have realization of the divine, not only partial realization, but a real realization in which the divine himself gives you the work consciously. Not that you think that everything comes from the divine, therefore my work is also divine's work. That is not true, it is falsehood. But many people who start doing yoga, they become deluded simply because now they are now turning towards the divine. They feel they have already become the instruments of the divine. One should be therefore extremely cautious, extremely humble. The true humility is to see that oneself for a long, 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 long time. One has to be a very sincere servant, offering his work to the divine, not claiming this is divine's work, his work as an offering to the divine, reminding that I am still thinking that I am egoistic doer, I am still in the meshes of the ego, but trying to get rid of it, and therefore offering myself again and again, until you reach a point when the divine himself gives you the work and says, do it. You can see, when Sri Aurobindo was in Alipur jail, then as a result of his long sadhana, Sri Krishna himself said, I have a work to do, and I am giving a part, a little bit of that work to you. In Alipur, if you read the Sri Aurobindo's account of Alipur experience in the jail, Sri Krishna says, I have work to do, a part of it I want to give you. And he reveals him what is that work. So one should therefore be very careful not to have the egoism of instrument. This is one of the great delusions that arises in the process of yoga, and one should be extremely careful. To claim I am the instrument of God, my Lord, don't have this delusion. When the realization comes that you are the instrument of the divine, you are extremely humble. You don't exist even to claim that you are the instrument of God. So, this is the stage at which only you can come to the third step, divine center of the world, of the divine in the world. Read again. But without realization, our mental belief cannot become a dynamic reality. It is still only a figure of knowledge, not a living truth. An idea, not yet a power. And even if realization has begun, it may be dangerous to imagine or to assume too soon that we are altogether in the hands of the Supreme or are acting as His instrument. That assumption may introduce a calamitous falsity. It may produce a helpless inertia or magnifying the movements of the ego with the divine name. It may disastrously distort and ruin the whole course of the yoga. There is a period, more or less prolonged, of internal effort and struggle in which the individual will has to reject the darkness and distortions of the lower nature and to put itself resolutely or vehemently on the side of the divine light. The mental energies, the heart's emotions, the vital desires, the very physical being have to be compelled into the right attitude or trained to admit and answer to the right influences. It is only then, only when this has been truly done, that the surrender of the lower to the higher can be effected, because the sacrifice has become acceptable. The personal will of the sadhaka has first to seize on the egoistic energies and turn them towards the light and the right. Once turned, he has still to train them to recognize that always, always to accept, always to follow that. Progressing, he learns, still using the personal will, personal effort, personal energies, to employ them as representatives of the higher power and the conscious obedience to the higher influence. Progressing yet farther, his will, effort, energy become no longer personal and separate, but activities of that higher power and influence at work in the individual. But there is still a sort of gulf of distance, which necessitates an obscure process of transit, not always accurate, sometimes even very distorting, between the divine origin and the emerging human current. At the end of the progress, with the progressive disappearance of egoism and impurity and ignorance, the last separation is removed. All in the individual becomes the divine working. This is the long process. Therefore, the right attitude is only to be a servant and a slave of God. Forever and ever and ever, until a time comes where you do not even know that you have become the instrument of God. You are the instrument of God. You have no time even to claim that you are instrument of God. This is the process of utsaha, the entire process of effort, which will culminate into this stage. I think tomorrow we shall come to the guru, the teacher. All right.